From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, director Steven Soderbergh, has pretty much made a film a year for the last 20 years since the debut of Sex, Lies, and Videotape in 1989. It is now 2009. Happy New Year, Mr. Soderbergh. Welcome.
Happy New Year. That's right.
Thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been a while.
It's absolutely been a while. You probably made like five. You actually have made five.
I think so, yeah.
I just realized that. But your newest movie is the two-part film of Che. One of the things I have to ask you about doing the film, because one of the things you said to me early on is that you want the film, you want people to react to it as a movie rather than a social phenomenology, and yet you're finding that's not happening at all, is it?
It's turned out to be one of those things where, yeah, people bring so much to it. They have such a personal idea of Che in one direction or another that I think they seem to be looking at it in terms other than cinematic terms. Certainly for me, it's an indication if somebody starts the discussion about the fact that the years in Cuba between the revolution and him going to Bolivia aren't in the movie, and they consider that to be a political act, my omission of that section, it means to me they haven't really looked at the film, because it's very clearly designed to be a sort of diptych of two campaigns that he fought in. And that was an artistic choice on my part, because that was the part of his life that I wanted to focus on. And so to not be able to look at the movie and see the logic of the artistic choice, but instead see it as a political choice, is an indication that you've come in with, you know, some sort of expectation about what you're going to see.
But, you know, if we go back to the person we refer to in every interview we've done here, Godard, every cut is a political act anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And certainly you know, I agree with him. I agree with Godard in the sense that as soon as you pick up a camera, you're lying to some extent or another. And by what you choose to show and not show, you're making some sort of statement. But I can only say I came into this sort of clean, and there wasn't, I didn't make a value judgment about the information that I was getting about Che through interviews or through what I read. You know, I read everything that was available to read, and I talked to everyone that was around that knew him that we could get to. You know, the interpreter that was with him, you know, the woman typist that was working in the Cuban mission with him, you know, we got all these details about he never wanted to eat in the dining room. He always ate in the kitchen. His interaction with this young driver who he sort of dresses down and then later makes up with, and all this great. I was trying to, while we were preparing this for years and years, those are the scenes I was looking for. I was looking for sort of human scale, one-on-one interactions between him and another character. This thing, not big scenes, but the scenes that normally would be before and after a big scene. That's the stuff I was trying to find. This is, you know, as close a representation as I could generate based on the feeling that I got from talking to people that knew him. And even the ones that really cared for him, you could tell there was a real distance to him, that he wasn't embraceable on a personal level. And so as a result, when people complain that the film is cold, I feel, yeah, that's appropriate. That's what I got from the people who were right next to him for a long time.
But also one of the things you do that, and I didn't really have a sense of this until I spent time in Cuba and got a chance to talk to people, is Castro as manipulator. Seeing him in part one as a military leader, but in part two as a politician, as somebody who knows exactly where things stand and understands really that he's using Che as kind of a sacrificial figure.
Well, there's no question that when Che, you know, we have Che in New York in the film giving the speech at the UN. A couple of months after that, he gave a speech in Algeria in which he slammed the Soviets and basically said, I don't really see the difference between, you know, Soviet imperialism and American imperialism. And he didn't tell anybody he was going to say this. And by all accounts, when he got back to Cuba, you know, they had a little sit down, he and Fidel. And my, I'm not a big conspiracy person. There's no question to me that there was probably a discussion revolving around the lines of, you really need to figure out what you want to be doing here because you're obviously not happy behind a desk. You don't know, you're not smart enough politically to be doing what I'm doing or you wouldn't have made that speech. And so what is it exactly that you feel like you ought to be doing? And there's no question that Che said from the very beginning, I want to take the revolution to the rest of Latin America. And I'm sure Fidel said maybe now is the time to do that. And as you know, he went to the Congo first, which is a whole other movie in itself.
By the way, I'm talking to Steven Soderbergh, whose new film is Che, starring Benicio del Toro. It's fascinating to me that because that was from something I kind of found myself expecting some allusion to, even though you kind of told me that wasn't going to be included, because it's that thing that really kind of changed him and changed. I mean, it was kind of like that final sort of rend between he and Castro.
Well, the Congo was fascinating for a lot of reasons. It's sort of a rehearsal for Bolivia. I mean,
in the worst way.
Yeah, it went terribly. Nobody asked him to come. Nobody knew he was coming. He just sort of showed up. What's interesting about it was there was a whole race issue playing out that was really fascinating because Che had brought all these black Cubans with him thinking that was a smart move. Well, it turned out the Africans were really not happy with the black Cubans. First of all, they didn't consider them to be black. Their attitude was, if you were black, you'd be here. And it's this whole other – there was this whole other layer to the problem of sort of interacting with the African rebel groups that's really, really fascinating. And there's a great quote from one of the African rebels that fought with Che, which is indicative and that I kept in mind. He said, Che would rather face a bullet than reality.
And it's really what the second half of the film is about. I mean, that kind of preparation – but I guess we should talk, too, about the very different way that the two movies are staged. I mean, because you treat him in the first half as much as a military hero, a ruthless military hero, as a media figure. I mean, there's that whole sense of being backstage with him as they're in New York, and he's about to make that. I mean, that to me, showing those two different worlds that he navigated and kind of the comfort levels or the lack thereof between those is a real key point that I find a lot of people are talking about and writing about the film.
When I found out about the New York trip, I just thought it was a gold mine because here, first of all, it was an organic way for him to sort of talk about his ideology. Second of all, he's at the absolute peak of his fame and notoriety here, December 64. It's a junket. I mean, he's a rock star and he's come right into the belly of the beast. And just the images of him from that period, which, you know, we made black and white. I just thought that juxtaposition and him as that guy, you know, going back each time to him in the jungle, not only provided us with the opportunity to make narrative leaps every time we came out of New York, and that helped us in the storytelling sense, but the way in which he sort of grows into being this guy who's kind of in the third person, you know what I mean? Because when he starts off, when we meet him, he's sort of wandering around lost and he's got asthma and he sort of screws up and gets berated by Fidel. And it's really interesting to me to watch that progression, to see him by the end of the movie. Actually, he takes over a slang term. Like, I don't know when this has ever happened before, that a guy whose nickname is a slang term basically takes it over to the point where it now means him instead of what the word used to mean. The word is like dude in Spanish. It's like calling somebody dude. So it's a strange thing.
It's the treatment, I guess, of director Steven Soderbergh, whose new film is Che. So much of that first half is about this kind of impatience he has. And that's a peculiar thing to dramatize with somebody that, for whom most of us have a strictly iconic relationship with, even if you've read the histories.
You know, here I'm coming at this, you know, I'm the gringo sort of walking into this situation.
And did that unnerve you a little bit being there?
Well, I thought there's got to be there's got to be some advantage to it because I don't have an agenda here. He's not an icon to me. I never felt like anything he had done it connected to me personally.
Even though for some level, he must exist as an iconic figure to you.
Yeah, but I didn't really. I didn't really have a sense of him. I mean, when we started.
Okay.
So then, I have to find some way. There is one that exists in which we share some experience or sensibility. And what I decided was work. I'm going to show him at work, in this case, fighting, because that's about process, and I understand process. I understand getting a group of people together and trying to go and do something that sometimes seems either crazy or impossible or correct or, you know, inevitable, any of those things. That's a feeling that I understand, and I understand the degree to which you feel responsible, the degree to which your energy is driving this thing. Those were, at least I felt, that's the closest that I can ever get to understanding any part of him. And so that's why I gravitated toward the kind of day-by-day how-to wage a war like this, because at least that was a process that I felt I could understand.
But that odd detachment he had and that real discomfort he had in sort of dealing with people.
Well, it's in his writing. That's where I got that from.
I mean, he looks at people as an abstraction.
Absolutely. And the style of the two parts is really designed to mimic the voice from the two texts that exist from these campaigns. The one text about the Cuban Revolution is obviously written after the fact and has the sort of, you know, distance and perspective that one has when you've been the victor. The Bolivian diaries, which were obviously contemporaneous, have a very, very different feel. There's no context. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know what's going to happen. And there's just a sense of dread that comes across in this much more first-person account of what's going on. And so I was looking for two styles that would basically mimic that voice, that tense of voice. And that's why the decision to shoot, you know, the first one in CinemaScope and the second one in 185 and go more handheld with the second one so that the outcome seems less predicted. I mean, everyone knows they won the Cuban Revolution. There's no mystery about whether they're going to win. The question is, how did they do it? So
in some ways, in the second part, I mean, the camera will move to catch something. It's almost and almost missing it, as if it really is happening before his eyes.
That happened a lot. And a lot of it wasn't. there's one shot that's in the movie. It's just before he's captured. I mean, literally just before he's captured, he's sort of stuck behind this tree, and he moves from this tree to a sort of place on a hill behind a rock, and that's when they get him. And it's a tight shot, and it starts on him, and he moves, and then the camera just loses him and chases him for a while and then finally finds him again after he's landed. What had happened was, in order to match the dust and the smoke, we set off another grenade bomb, smoke, dirt bomb right next to me so that all this stuff would match. I couldn't see anything. And so literally I couldn't see a thing. And so I went from the first 5 seconds of the shot being able to see him to being able to see nothing and just stumbling after him and then finding him after he landed. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. Like, if I'd meant to do it, it wouldn't have been cool. But the fact that it was a total screw-up gave it some kind of actual integrity. So it's in the movie.
20 years of happy accidents. My guest is Steven Soderbergh. His new film is Che. It's The Treatment. More after this.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. My guest is director Steven Soderbergh. A Film a Year. His newest is Che. Let's talk, though. I mean, it's you're going to go to Sundance in a couple of weeks. It's been 20 years since Sex, Lies, and Videotape. In an odd way, it feels like Che is kind of the answer to that movie, a movie that's sort of about people trying to find experience and figure out what they are. And then in a number of the films that you've done are about people trying to find some sense of themselves. You look at Schizopolis.
Or people who feel that through sheer will they can make the world more the way they want it to be. I mean, that's certainly something that that I'm attracted to in a character.
Yes.
And Che is the most extreme version of that.
But that kind of exercise is often solipsistic
for
some of the people that you including putting yourself in one of those films. That's why I said one of them. And sort of ridiculing that kind of that self-absorption. But that need to sort of figure out and force your sense of yourself on the world is a pretty interesting thing to continue to dramatize.
I think it's a natural impulse for us to try and make order out of what the hell's going on here. And asking questions about why is it this way and not that way. And, you know, I've made a lot of films that are sort of fragmented and follow a nonlinear structure. I'm one of these people that feels that things aren't as ordered as they appear, and that there's kind of a tacit agreement that we all have to share in order just to not go nuts, that there's some kind of real structure to what's happening around us. I think part of what makes us feel that way is that time moves in one direction, at least as we experience it. And so there's a narrative that's implied by that fact. But I tend to think we kind of exist in a couple of different realms at the same time, in that if I'm walking down the street, I'm thinking about something that happened a week ago, I'm thinking about something I've got to do tomorrow, and then I'm also walking down the street and I have to make sure I don't step off the curb and get hit. And that's, I think, a pretty natural state for most people. It's a state that film, when it's, you know, working correctly, can really duplicate in a wonderful and unique way, almost better than any other art form. And so I'm really drawn to that because I feel it is very close to our experience, that kind of fragmented structure. So that's, you know, I've got the film that I've just finished, The Girlfriend Experience, is much closest thing to The Limey in terms of structure that I've done since The Limey. It's a very fragmented sort of nonlinear piece, and that's been really fun.
What drove you to re-explore that?
Well, I think in this case, it was in a real attempt to get you inside the emotional life of this character, this woman who's like a high-end escort, and it's really a 5-day period in her life that's set in a very specific time in October of last fall, just before the election. And it just turned out to be the best way to show her up and down emotional state during those 5 days.
But as you talk about, you mentioned The Limey, which again, we're dealing with a figure, Terrence Stamp, having a kind of an iconic presence for a lot of people, and you're kind of exploring that. I mean, that's something that brings us back to Che a little bit, you know, I mean, in some ways.
Well, you've certainly, in the Limey, you've got kind of the equivalent of the New York footage. You've got this footage of Terrence from 1968 from another film, but playing, you know, the implication is he's playing, you know, that same character 30 years later. And that's, I think those, you know, I think playing with those ideas of representation are interesting. You know, just like somebody was saying the other day, well, you know, when you Google Che right now, Benicio's picture pops up. And I thought, well, I guess that's progress.
Of a sort. It's The Treatment. My guest is director Steven Soderbergh. His new film, currently in release, going wider now, is Che. But in looking just – and I haven't done this for a long time, but I was traveling a lot recently, so I had a chance to like watch all the films one after another to think about this. And what happens is as your confidence level grew as a director, instead of like making these big kind of commitments to narrative, you chose to like wander further and further away from that and to really explore that kind of fragmented. I mean, people reacting to something after it's happened to them later in the film. And,
right.
And it's a really interesting thing to watch play out over the course of all these movies.
I think it's because film is so pliable and being in the editing room is to me the best place to be in the world. There's just so many possibilities. You have to be smart about this.
Too many though. Possibilities?
I mean, well, it can be. I mean, there are times when the number of parallel movies that could exist start to freak you out. And you do. I'm pretty good about just giving myself a certain amount of time, frankly, and saying you have to stop now. And you also have to be smart about when to rein that stuff in. You don't want to make Aaron Brockovich that way. Then you're not being smart.
Except even in Aaron Brockovich, there's still that kind of this weird, almost like an echo, an emotional echo of her sort of, I mean, even though she's going through this thing like a soldier, she's still kind of keeping in mind, you know, the repercussions of all these acts. And there's always that sense in the films, maybe not from the protagonist, but in the film itself, of an understanding of each action having a repercussion.
Well, I hope that's true. I see a lot of films.
But consequence is very important to you, isn't it?
Well, I think you see a lot of films that sort of leap from peak to peak, and there's no, you know, they just go from mountaintop to mountaintop, these scenes, you know, and you just feel like, well, that's fine, but that doesn't feel like my life. And even if you're making an entertainment, there should be some aspect to it, I think, that feels like somebody's life somehow. And especially when it comes to a dramatic event, whether it's a piece of violence, physical violence or emotional violence, I'm a big believer in showing what the fallout from that is. That those things, for a lot of people, I mean, everybody's been in a situation where, you know, I'm the kind of person, if somebody yelled at me, like, for days, I'm thrown by that. I'm not a very confrontational person. It takes a lot for me to go there. I've made 20 films. I've never yelled on a film set.
But you know what? Finally, for me, it comes down to in all these films, it's about choices. The characters almost always make too late. That's kind of an amazing thing. But even down to, if we take it up to Che, it's about a choice made too late. But in some ways, and it's the one kind of through line that these people feel like they have to, like, go through with these things anyway. There's almost some kind of weird predestination in it.
Well, I think there's a line, and I would never do this. It's a line from Solaris, and I'm only going to quote it because a friend of mine wrote it, not me, a friend of mine who I'd given the script to and came back with this line that I thought was great, where at one point the character says, "There are no answers, only choices." And that sort of sums up my attitude, I guess, which is that despite all the time that I spend trying to, you know, organize this world and make sense of it for my own purposes, at the end of the day, I feel like all that you do have are your choices, and that those are the only answers you're going to get, that there are no, you're never going to get, we're never going to figure out, we're never going to find the pattern in pie. It's just not going to happen. And you're probably happier if you accept that. As a result, I tend to, at least as a filmmaker, take my choices pretty seriously in the sense that I'm trying to push myself and at the same time not know what my strengths are and know there are certain kind of things that I'm not really good at that I shouldn't be doing or that if I were left to my own devices with certain kinds of material, I would strip it of the very thing that made it compelling in the first place. So like a comic book film, I can't make a comic book film. The Ocean's movies are as close as I can get to that, because if you gave me a comic book, I'd end up pulling all the stuff out of it that people like that read comic books. So you have to know, you know, you have to know your strengths, and at the same time, you want to be pushed. You know, so if I say, look, I can't drive the lane, I'm good from shooting outside, that still means I want to play the best people, but I just can't drive the lane. You know, and I accept that, and I'm not going to waste everybody else's time by trying to drive the lane all day. It's really just sort of figuring out what you can do and then pushing yourself really hard in that direction. One of the things I figured out is I'm not really a writer. I've written, but I'm not a writer, not by my definition.
Which is what?
I'm just not. I wrote by default. I wrote because it was a way in, But I'm not. I know, right? I've worked with real writers, and I'm telling you, I'm not a real writer. It's a different way of thinking, and it's a different discipline. And my best work, in my opinion, has been written by other people.
It's funny you say that because it makes me wonder if you've watched Sex, Lies, and Videotape at all in the past few years.
No, I watched it in 98 when it was remastered for DVD. That's the last time I've seen it.
And no interest to watch it again at all? Or?
I can't imagine it's not really dated. You know?
Really? Like, okay.
But I mean, you know, like not in a good way. I don't know. I'm really terrified to watch it now and see the hair. Because I know the hair is going to be 20 years old.
It's back now.
Yeah, maybe it's gone. It's been gone so long. Maybe it is back.
It's the treatment, I guess, as director Steven Soderbergh, whose new film is Che. But for somebody who uses films as a reference point and watches films, I just wondered if there were films that were reference points for you for Che. I mean, there seem to be some obvious ones, but I'll let you talk about them.
Well, strangely enough, the first one was all these John Sturges movies. I was watching a Bad Day at Black Rock and The Great Escape and things like that, which may seem really odd. But
no, because if you're looking at those films, what all the Sturges films were about people proving themselves in action rather than in conversation.
Yeah, and there's very little sort of backstory. There are no relationships, and they're very clean. They're really beautifully laid out. The guy really knew how to shoot, but he was very simple, very smart.
And characters who don't exist in any other context other than the action.
Exactly. And so that's what I was watching for the first one. For the second one, I was watching the early Friedkin stuff. I was watching French Connection and Sorcerer.
Which is really about the kind of an existential sense of doom and a mission, again, that it's going to be completed even though, again, another wrong decision that's going to be carried out until the end.
Yeah. Sorcerer is a really underrated movie, I think. It was one of the, you know, it came out literally like 2 weeks after Star Wars in summer of 77, long delayed, over budget, you know.
And I think I think the second big studio collaboration, the first being
Universal Paramount, it was that big that it needed two studios to finance it. And a lot of expectations, you know, a remake of a classic movie. You know, it's sort of, I look at it now and I think there's fantastic stuff in it. They're just stunning sequences in it. And it's really beautiful and very spare.
And takes its time.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's, you know, that's what I was watching for the second one, that kind of just terse, lean style.
Well, we're out of time. Thanks again. You know, if you want to come back in another 20 years, I'll probably still be doing this.
Oh, God. Okay, good.
Okay, thanks. My guest is Steven Soderbergh. His new film as director is Che, or in parts of your neighborhood, Che Part 1 and 2. Our recording engineer at Argo Network in New York is Paul Ruess. Bob Carlson's the editor. Jimmy Dempsey's the producer. Viva la Revolution. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.